This is the podcast for May 11th, 2012. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from just outside the Wild Rumpus, it's the Professional Left with Drift Glass and Blue Gal.
And we will miss Maury Sendak.
Yes, we will.
Let the Wild Rumpus start. I think there's a Wild Rumpus starting. I don't know if... You know, that Barack Obama kind of started a wild rumpus, you know.
Well, and we both are from the families of educators.
Yeah.
And readers. Yeah, we're readers, folks. Get used to it. We're here. We read. Get used to us. And books like that always figured prominently in both of our childhoods, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, yeah.
Fair to say. And in the passing the that subversive literature down to another generation has been... our great pleasure.
Well, and the Wild Things is such a seminal book about unconditional love and discipline and fear and scary thoughts that can't hurt you and being brave in the face of those thoughts and has so much to give us in terms of a political lesson as well. I know Maury Sendak probably didn't intend it that way, but... I did a Photoshop a few years ago of Barack Obama in Max's outfit in the sailboat sailing away, and all of the Wild Things were Fox News people. And they were all roaring their terrible roar and gnashing their terrible teeth, and he said no and sailed away. And I think we're going to talk a lot about Barack Obama today. One of the things that I fault Barack Obama for is paying too much attention to Fox News, and I wish he would see them in the light of the Wild Things that just are going to we'll eat you up, you know. And, and they really don't have, they only have as much power as you give them.
Well, and speaking of terrifying ideas that have no actual ability to hurt you at all,
gay marriage,
and. And before we – but split right between those two, I think we need to shout out a Happy Mother's Day, yes?
Oh, yeah. Happy Mother's Day to everybody, all the moms, our moms. We're both very blessed that our moms are still around.
Yep.
And
– still awesome.
Still awesome. So we're glad of that, and thank you, and Happy Mother's Day to both of you.
Happy Mother's Day. Happy Mother's Day.
And now we're going to talk about Obama and gay marriage.
Oh, Lord. Yeah.
Which – I have to say, I've noticed, and one of our listeners noticed, just him saying that has started a lot of conversations. Conversations that I didn't expect to have today with people.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's brought out something that people want to talk about. And I'm grateful to the president for that outcome, whether he intended that outcome or not. That's what's happened, is we're all of a sudden talking about rights and choices and being who you are, and I'm having to come out as a liberal to a lot of people where I wasn't necessarily out of kindness, not being out there, and having to say, oh, by the way, I have lots of gay friends and I'm on this side of this issue. Reasonable people can disagree reasonably. I'm not going to attack you, but I disagree with what you just said. And that's a scary place to be in certain settings.
It is.
And I had to be there today, and we had a wonderful letter just this morning that you're going to read from one of our listeners about this very issue.
Absolutely. It's a delightful letter, a quick note from a correctional officer, also known as a prison guard.
I want to say we love our correctional officer listeners.
Yes. Get ready.
The ones that are out there.
Get ready for some hot correctional officer on correctional officer, man on man.
Oh, my God. Don't go there.
Why not?
Because you want Waka Jawaka music in the podcast.
I always do. So, you know, settle in, guys. Pop a cold one in here.
Oh, man.
Here comes the action. Not much was happening when correctional officer Joe, not his real name. So my coworkers, I'm beginning the letter.
Okay, yeah. Why don't you start over and just read the letter now?
Fine. Just a quick note. I'm a correctional officer, so my coworkers are more conservative than most. A friend who knows my politics started the conversation by asking me about Obama and same-sex marriage. Yet pulled the pin on that grenade, just rolled it in the room. Mm-hmm. At first, we talked about the politics of it and if this will help Obama or not. Then we talked about the issue itself. He didn't understand how it could be a civil rights issue. I explained that when people are discriminated over an aspect of themselves they can't change, it is a civil rights issue. He started to argue, so I asked him if he thought being gay was a choice. I then asked him when he chose to desire women over men. This caught him off guard, no pun intended, I'm sure. I did my best to explain that if we chose our sexuality, then when did he choose his and put it to him this way? Did you think you could ever have sex with a man? I'm sure a gay man has the same feelings when it comes to having sex with a woman. He asked me if I thought that there should be any limits to what people can do. I answered, what two consenting adults do in the privacy of their own home is not my business. A very libertarian, conservative, and liberal issue. I think this is one that everybody agrees on in principle. This is just a drift class aside. He then asked if it was okay to watch kiddie porn. I answered that to support an industry that abuses children is much different than how two consenting adults choose to have sex, as the children are not consenting nor adults. Uh-oh, yeah, there is that, isn't there? The morality issue was brought up by another officer, one who really is a meat stick, as DG would say. This officer said that he believed that it was morally wrong. I asked on what basis and what did Jesus ever say about homosexuality. I pointed out that Jesus loved to hang around with prostitutes and tax collectors and other riffraff. He didn't say anything about being gay, but he said a lot about the rich not going to heaven. At the end, the first officer was mostly silent and probably thinking. The second officer, the meat stick, was talking about how this could ruin the family, although he admitted it would have no effect on his family. I pointed out that children with gay parents on average do better than straight, because gay parents never have unwanted pregnancies or children. He pressed if they were better parents. I explained that no, I did not say that. I simply said on average they produce better results. He would not accept this. At one point in the conversation, he pressed me how I know this. Basically, he did not like my facts, so he was going to diss the source of my facts. He did not want to believe that the country is becoming more accepting of gay marriage. To prove this point, I pointed to the fact that both Romney and Obama have softened their views on gay marriage, which is actually not true. They've reversed their positions, but in polar opposite ways. Mm-hmm. There must be a reason for that. Finally, he started the conversation by referring to Obama's flip-flop. I pointed out that I don't want to hear that term being used against Obama when there is not an issue out there that Romney has not had five different views on. To this, he totally agreed.
Thank you for that letter. And yeah. And I've noticed that in overhearing conversations in restaurants and so forth that, boy, even Republicans, even lifelong Republicans think Romney's a flip-flopper.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You'll gain points there. They'll vote for him anyway, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I get those emails almost every day. The Obama's hated around the world. Look at all these things that Obama. It's tiresome. Yeah. I don't bother anymore because there's no point in having that conversation anymore. But when an issue like this comes up that really jams a really touchy social issue back into the headlines, mm-hmm. In a way that nobody was quite expecting.
Yeah.
Then you suddenly have this space suddenly opened up in the public square where you can start having really interesting conversations about what it means to be an American, what it means to be civil, what does civil rights mean? What do you think the intersection of faith should be and governance? And lots of those conversations. And it turns out, unsurprisingly, that a lot of conservatives have really stupid opinions about those things, really deeply held, passionate, incredibly inconsistent, wrong, dumbass opinions about those that they get to mask over every day mm-hmm. because the issue just doesn't come up every day. And so when it comes out into light, they look like idiots because you start asking them the really basic questions about why do you care what consenting adults do? What does their behavior on some desert island somewhere that you'll never know about or see have to do with you? And And what about the scripture says that this is a bad thing? When did Jesus ever talk about this? And it rocks them back on their heels to have liberals, I think, really come to the table prepared and calm and take them on point by point. And I'm not saying you're ever going to win that argument, because you probably won't. Because nothing you say or do is going to change the mind of the meat stick.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back, too, to the idea that this is going to hurt traditional marriage, because there is a perception, and it's a very real perception among people, that traditional marriage is in decline, that people aren't getting married. They're having children out of wedlock. You know, 40% of the children born in Illinois now are born out of wedlock.
Yeah.
And that is true. That is happening. And what we need to focus on in our conversations with people about that is, I'm going to go full-blown Marxist on you, Driftglide, is that this is an economic situation.
Yeah. Really,
I remember many years ago watching a wonderful program on PBS called The Story of English. And it was narrated by Robert McNeil, and he was talking about the history of the English language. As an aside in this, he talked about marriage, because when a French person marries an English person in England, and there will be things like, why is it beef on the table and cow in the field? Why, you know, these different words, because the language of the manor is French. And when the French were in England as owning manors and so forth, and the language of the field was field hands, and they called it a cow. And so there were different words used. And it's a fascinating thing. But one of the things Robert McNeil said as an aside, he was talking about the English language and people living in huts made of peat and moss and dug into the side of hills. And this, so how long ago was that? I don't remember what century he was talking about. But he was describing this imaginary couple during that time. And he said, like couples throughout history, our sample couple here did not get married until they could afford a house. And that is true today. We have a crisis in marriage because of the housing economy.
Yeah.
Period.
Well, the collapse of the middle class.
The collapse of the middle class. And the collapse of the middle class came way after the housing bubble.
Yeah.
When young couples were priced out of the housing market.
Well, I would disagree with you there, respectfully. The collapse of the middle class began, I would argue, 1978,
79, 80. Okay. With the... Well, 73 then, with the oil.
With the oil shock. Yeah. And you know how I feel about this, Blue Gal.
Yes, I do.
That marriage is a machine. It's a delight in many other things, but it's a machine. And the minute you blow a carburetor, the minute the nuclear family requires two salaries to support its basic economic integrity, it begins to fall apart. Mm-hmm. It comes under stress. And it's a modular unit that only operates efficiently within a very specific kind of economy. It's highly mobile. It's very corporate friendly. It's very suburban based. But the support structures that make the human race possible, the large extended family with loose affiliations in small villages, that's what we're wired to be, fall apart when you have a nuclear family. And in a nuclear family, you're basically stripped of your traditional social contacts. You're stripped of your traditional
Your support system.
Familial
with the elderly.
Support. Yep. Absolutely. And you're stuck in a suburb. Yep. And as long as dad can go out and make enough money to keep the house and the cars and the education and the tax base and blah, 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 blah running so that mom can devote all of her time and effort. One parent could be either parent, but one parent can devote all the time to the other function of the family, which is the development and maintenance of the next generation, then it works. But the minute you put any kind of stress on that particular, totally artificial, incredibly recent American-made product called the nuclear family, it splinters and it splits and it starts to fall apart. And then you start developing social programs to keep that model patched together.
And, of course, that model isn't nearly as ideal as we're describing it.
Because
the dissatisfaction of women within that structure, the abuse of women within that structure, it was very patriarchal and very wrong on lots of levels, not necessarily good for kids.
Yeah.
And, you know, everyone wants to go back to Mad Men because you could smoke and fuck and drink and have a good time with, you know, hot secretaries all the time. That's not the ideal for anybody. It's not a humanly friendly society.
And that analogy runs all the way from the family unit to things like adoption.
Yeah.
You know, go out to the American frontier and look at how children were moved in and out of families if, you know, the family 20 miles away was wiped out and left kids. Did you send them back to the East Coast? No, you probably took them in, probably took care of them. They became your cousins or your kids. Much more, the environment in which families are compelled to survive creates its own structure. And the ones that function well and adapt well to that environment continue. And the ones that don't, they fail. But the idea that gayness is involved anywhere in there, in the definition of why a family succeeds, why a family fails, is ludicrous and funny and stupid and sad. What gayness does do, though, is the same thing that interracial marriage threatened to do, which was threaten patriarchy. It threatens the hierarchy of society.
Yep.
Because if you can take away from me that last thing that makes me special and unique in the eyes of God, that you can't have, but I can have because I'm white and straight and male, then, and I'm living in a fucking double wide in sister fuck Arkansas, then what do I have? I have no social identity at all. I'm actually lower than everyone else, and I have no hope of escape of my misery. And we talked a little bit about slum prudery during our pregame, which is
Slum prudery is in Pygmalion, the play that became My Fair Lady. But the movie Pygmalion is so much better than My Fair Lady. Go get that. 1938, Leslie Howard and Wendy Hiller. So wonderful. Mm-hmm. But he does. Professor Higgins brings in Eliza Doolittle, and she doesn't want to change her clothes because she's a good girl. Mm-hmm. And he says, no, you're going to become a duchess. I'm going to change the way you talk. Mm-hmm. And that's going to make you into a duchess. And duchesses don't give a rat's ass about how they are perceived sexually because they have money and power.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't need to be sexually pure in order to be genteel.
That's exactly right.
And that's what we're dealing with here with Christianity and needing to be better than everybody as a Christian. And that goes into abortion. I've written about this.
Yep.
The difference between Palin's daughter, Bristol, nobody would be having sex if everybody knew what sex was all about and how terrible it is that you have unwanted pregnancies, and I'm going to become a spokesmodel now for abstinence. Having failed miserably at it. Mm-hmm. And Meghan McCain, whose tits are all over Twitter. I mean, you know, she can afford to have sex because she's got money. And she comes from the aristocracy of a brewer, you know.
Military
and brewery aristocracy. So she can afford to have, you know, not. She doesn't need sexual purity to appear genteel. She has money.
That her credibility as a person
of value, a woman of value,
exactly, doesn't come from
her virginity.
Virginity,
yeah,
it comes from her money and her family and her status, and that is so important to understand because the issue of abortion and the issue of gay marriage are related
to
that particular way.
Yeah,
it has everything to do with sex and hierarchy.
Yeah,
it has everything to do with who is in charge and who's in power. Meghan McCain belongs to the power elite. People below that level, who are incredibly class conscious, worship the power elite. They worship corporate titans. They worship Bain Capital, even though those are the people that might have fucked them out of a job, destroyed their company, wrecked their country. They're powerful, and these people have been trained like circus seals to worship power, worship money, because that's the fucking American dream. And when you're in the gutter and you've got nothing, and all you have is, you know, again, if you're just a double wide dweller in sister fuck Arkansas, and all you do is listen all week long to Rush Limbaugh tell you what to think. You worship money, you worship power, and you despise people who want to take away your last little talisman of being a member of the upper class.
The class, of being classy. Yep, sexually classy.
It's never going to be your money. It's never going to be your education. So you sneer at those things. It's never going to be your position or the order of your birth. So you sneer at those things. It's never going to be the quality of the way you present yourself in public or how intelligent you appear to be. And that's why they hate Barack Obama, because he is everything that they feared would happen once blacks and whites were allowed to marry.
Yep.
So the last little thing they have to cling to, and this is quite accurate, Barack Obama is quite accurate when he talks about clinging to their guns and their Bible. The last thing they have to cling to is their weapons, because they can still kill you. They'll they can still shoot somebody and make them die. And that book that tells them that they're better. They're better than – it doesn't appear to be, but
even though it doesn't say that, they can hold it up and say,
Even though that doesn't say that at all, even though it tells them exactly the opposite. But it's the magic charm that keeps the horror of their existence at bay. And letting gay people be treated like everybody else takes away that last little bit of preferential difference
over other people.
And they can't stand that. They cannot stand that, because after that, they have nothing left. Nothing at all.
So I'm glad this conversation has started, and I think there are people thinking about it. I also wanted to talk about how for Christianity, speaking as a Christian, and someone who goes to church way too often, karma's a bitch.
Yeah.
And the evangelical Christian churches that have aligned themselves over and over again with the Republican Party are finding that their churches are one of two things. Either they're crystal cathedrals with televised ministries that are really susceptible to financial malfeasance and sexual problems in the ministry. Let me put it that way. Went nicely. Scandal.
Uh-huh.
Or they are churches full of old people, and they are dying. Their churches are dying.
Yeah. Demography.
And that's it. And it's if you're sitting in a church where everyone's an octogenarian and there's no fresh blood coming in and there's no one there to carry on your edifice, karma's a bitch. And this is something that one of the banks in North Carolina was freaking out about this Amendment 1 thing. It's like, you know, we're not going to get any young people to move to North Carolina if this passes, right? Straight or gay. Mm-hmm. You know, this is going to be seen as, wow, that's a really backwater Southern bigot hole. I don't want to be there.
Yeah.
And if you want to join the 21st century, then we can't have this kind of bigotry.
And yet.
Money talk. Yeah, and yet they did. And
they did.
I'm really glad that part of the conversation that we had with that minister from North Carolina is about what happens when you vote for other people's rights. It never passes.
Right.
The people that can vote for other people's rights always deny other people's rights.
Power has to be seized.
Yep.
Power has to be taken, preferably by peaceful means. But power is always taken, never ceded.
Never given.
And that's a primary truth of political reality in human nature. And everybody knows it. So every time you hear someone wanting to put up someone else's rights to a plebiscite, that means they don't want them to have those rights. They want to take them away or keep them away from them for some reason. And they should be the ones on trial. The minute you open your mouth and say, let's do this on a ballot, you should be on trial. Yep. You and your beliefs and your ideology should be on trial, because that is profoundly ugly. And you know why you're doing it.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And you're appealing to the mob. That's not the American way, Blue Cow.
Richard Lugar lost his primary battle this week.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. Surprise, surprise.
Was I saying karma is a bitch?
Yeah.
When was I saying that? Yeah. Karma's a bitch, Richard Lugar.
Well, yeah. He did, didn't he? To that guy who said that his idea of bipartisanship was...
Oh, yeah. Compromise means Democrats become Republicans. That's essentially what he said. And you and I looked at one another and went...
Shrug.
Centrism.
Yeah. Well,
he said out loud what David Gregory has been programming for 4 years.
Yeah, well, for much longer than
that. Well, he hasn't been on Meet the Press for longer than that. But yes.
The basic message of Washington, D.C. and the Beltway media has always been, it is the job of Democrats to compromise with Republicans, not the other way around.
Yep.
And when it comes down to actual discussions of the issue, that's why they don't talk about issues. That's why they don't talk about right and wrong or facts or the arc of history or who is substantively more logical or who's even more internally consistent. They only talk about process. That's the only thing we want to talk about, because it keeps these incredibly well-paid, lying assholes from having to come out and say, we like the status quo. We like the establishment. We have an enormous amount of power. David Brooks just bought himself a $4 million mansion.
Yep.
In an upscale neighborhood in Washington, D.C.
Doubled the price value of his house.
Doubled the
from
price
from $1.6 to $3.4 million.
Which he had no trouble selling, by the way. Unlike me, he had no trouble selling his place.
Yeah.
And all of that multi-million
dollar. That's why I thought maybe you ought to change the price on your condo from $279,000 to $1.6 million.
I think, first of all, add a zero to it. Second, I go back in time and spend the last 15 years being ardent centrist.
Yeah, yeah.
And because that's where if you want to draw a straight line between why does David Brooks keep saying the incredibly stupid, lying, hackish, centrist crap that he does, and draw a straight line between that and who we believe might be in his stock portfolio, like energy stocks and defense contractor stocks, and being able to afford a $4 million mansion in an upscale neighborhood, that's the answer to that question. Oh, it pays really well to do that. It pays really, really well to do that. And the thing is, I don't want to get into a David Brooks thing today, but there is this matter of memory. And on two separate and non-contiguous occasions in the last 3 weeks, the only thing I had to do to, if I may put this as humbly as possible, to completely eviscerate something stupid that David Brooks wrote in the New York Times, in America's newspaper of record, was just to go back to 2003 and read what David Brooks said 8 years ago. That's all I had to do.
It was the opposite.
It was the exact opposite.
Yep. Yep.
Back when a white Republican was in the White House, he held absolutely opposite opinions on military triumphalism. And
on the deficit,
on
the debt.
And on
stimulus spending.
and on stimulus spending specifically, on stimulus spending because the world economy is stagnant and kids are graduating college.
And not able to find jobs. We've got to find a job for them,
Japan can't fix this. Europe can't fix this. The only people who can fix this is the United States government.
And they have to do it by stimulus and tax cut stimulus.
But it was astonishing. It was absolutely as naked and as brazen and as calculated a flip-flop as anything Mitt Romney has done. And yet...
Well, and that's what I want to say about...
Not a soul in the media is going to call David Brooks out on his bullshit.
And that's why I want to say something nice, Driftglass, about the Republican House. Because my mother, happy Mother's Day, Mom, I'm quoting you now.
Uh-huh.
My mother always said that you can always find something nice to say about everyone.
Yes.
Hitler loved his canary.
He did.
That's what she always said. Hitler loved his canary. You can always find something nice to say about everyone.
And his dog.
And so, well, she never said dog. She always said canary. But anyway, I would like to congratulate the House Republicans for their transparency.
Yeah.
Because they are so transparently bullshit assholes about the spending thing where they are attempting to undo the defense cuts that they voted for as a compromise to get, you know, if we aren't able to deal with the debt ceiling, we'll have automatic cuts. That'll take care of it.
Yeah.
And we'll have automatic cuts in defense and domestic spending, right? And then it was like 2 days later that McCain came out and said, well, we voted on that. We'll just unvote on it.
Yeah, we'll take
that. Sure enough, the House Republicans are voting to change the defense cuts to domestic cuts.
Yeah.
And no tax increases of any kind to increase revenue. So I would like to congratulate them on their transparent assholiness.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's pretty clear. If you don't see it now, you're willfully blind.
Well, yeah. And that's
there are a lot of voters out there like that.
If that had not been the liberal critique of the media for as long as I've been sentient, then I would be, you know, I'd be outraged. But I'm not outraged because the game is a business.
Yeah.
And the game is don't ever keep propping these lunatics up or else there's no game. Mm-hmm. There's no process. There's no contest. There's nothing to get, you know, viewers to watch us. So no matter how batshit they are, no matter how many times they lie, no matter how much bullshit they pull off, credit them, bring them on the air, embrace them, put them on television, stick a camera in front of them, and just keep doing it. And again, I don't fault Alan West, for example, for being nuts.
Yeah.
I don't fault the House Republicans for being nuts. I fault the voters in those districts for being really, really embarrassments to the very idea of citizenry, to being that completely bereft of social conscience and responsibility that they would vote for obviously crazy people like that. And secondly, I absolutely hold responsible the people, our fourth estate, whose job it is to call out bullshit when they see it,
who
will tell you, we're not going to do that because it's bad for our fucking ratings. We're going to put John McCain and Newt Gingrich on until the end of time because it's good for our ratings. And fuck you if you don't like it. If they lie, fuck you. I don't care.
Well,
I got
here's
a house.
What I want to know, Drift Class, and it's something we'll never find out because these are carefully guarded secrets. You've always asked, you know, who makes these decisions?
Yes.
I also want to know at what point – and this is something John Stewart's very good about and very honest about. Uh-huh. At what point did the host of Meet the Press join the 1%?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Because there was a point at which on-air talent became enormously rich. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't always the case that, you know, Huntley and Brinkley were paid enormously more than anyone else in America.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not the case anymore. We'll never actually find that out, but wage inflation for on-air talent, that's something that John Stewart always talks about. Oh no, you know, whenever they're talking about economics and tax cuts and so forth, and John Stewart will say, oh no, I'm rich. I'm one of those people. I make, you know, I have millions of dollars. I can admit that.
Go back to one of my favorite scenes from broadcast news.
Yeah, yeah.
This is 1987, I think.
Yeah, when Jack Nicholson, they ask him to take a pay cut to save 20 jobs in the newsroom, right?
He's there. He's the celebrity reporter.
Yeah.
He's the celebrity anchor. He's there sort of supervising the layoff.
Yeah.
And just shake his head about how awful it all is and how tragic. And the director or the producer, whoever's in charge of the network, is there, craven little suck up. And he's saying, is she gone? He's, yeah, yeah. Oh, it's just a shame. It hits them so hard. If there was only something I could do. And
well,
the executives as well. If we could shave $1 million off your salary, it could. And
you save every job in this place.
Well,
fuck you, I'm out of here.
Nicholson just turns and looks at him.
Yeah.
And it gives him this look like, how fucking dare you even consider.
Yeah.
And the network executive just falls to his knees and says, I am so sorry. That was just a horrible joke. It was just a bad – it's the pressure of the day. I'm so sorry.
It's just a terrible thing I said.
But even – this is 20 years ago. 20 years ago.
Yeah.
The distinction between the upper cast of the news industry, the people who were making staggering amounts of money, and the foot soldiers were – you know, this is – it's a far cry from Mike Royko, who grew up – you know, over a bar, and who reported on the neighborhoods he understood and who could extrapolate from what he knew about.
And the contacts he made there. People on the street knew who he was.
Yes, and knew he was honest.
Yeah.
And you might disagree with him, but you knew he was not going to bullshit you. Extrapolating that to commentary on the national scene that was credible and well-written. And he wrote a goddamn column every day. He didn't come strolling in twice a week and crap in the New York Times 800 words and go back to his mansion in Washington.
Oh, he craps it in his mansion, though. I mean, he doesn't leave his mansion to go anywhere.
But, And once they had become – and let's face it. If Mike Royko ever lost his job, and he did several times, he could get a job as a softball coach, which he loved, or running a bar. There were 20 other things Royko could have done, not nearly as good because that would be a waste of immense talent and genius. But think about it. If David Brooks lost his job tomorrow as the leading – public intellectual, American conservative public intellectual who's absolutely relentlessly stooges for this incredibly dishonest point of view, easily disputable, debunkable point of view. If he ever lost his job doing that, what else could he do? He has no other skills I have been able to discern. He was a history major in college. And since pretty much that day, since the day Bill Buckley put his hands on his head,
he's been wingnut
all
David welfare.
Brooks has done for a living has been living off of wingnut welfare and beating up on liberals and sucking up to people in power. That's all He does. And if he lost that job tomorrow, he would. Now, the truth of the matter is, if he lost a job at the New York Times, some of his friend would get him a job at Time
WAPO.
Magazine.
Oh, at Washington Post, yeah.
Somewhere else. He will never be without work because he has.
Oh, if Bill Kristol can keep a job, yeah. David Brooks can keep a job anywhere.
Absolutely.
Sure.
So it's not like, but it is that. It is that clubbiness. That's why, you know, that's why Digby calls it the Village.
Yeah.
It is an absolute club. It is Rome at its most corrupt. And you cannot break that monopoly because too many people are too invested in lying in exactly the same way to ever permit that. And there was a moment. I just want to, as a brief aside, I want to say there was just a moment in 2007, 2008, back when Netroots Nation was rising up and the Bush administration was in full collapse, when everything, all the Republican lies were blazing, you know, were burning to the ground, and everyone could see it from space. Oh my God, the Republican Party is a complete lying shithole catastrophe. And there was a moment when the DLC, Harold Ford Jr.'s Circle Jerk Democratic Leadership Conference, tried to get all the Democratic candidates for president to come down to Tennessee and talk about centrism with Al Fromm. And every single one of them said, fuck no. We're going to Netroots Nation instead. They went to the home of liberals. There was a time, a brief moment there, when the focused power of liberalism broke through. And there's this lovely little scene from Meet the Press being mediated by David Gregory, where you have Harold Ford Jr. on one side and Marcus Melitzis on the other.
Yeah.
Marcus Melitzis, as I said, sitting there slapping David Brooks's dick out of Harold Ford's mouth.
Well, and I think at that point, too, people weren't quite sure about the power of the Netroots and didn't want to take a risk.
Yeah.
And the other thing, though, you and I met with someone who attended several Netroots Nations meetings. And you and I have only been to one, or you've been to two, right?
I've been to two. One in Chicago, where all the candidates for president were there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But there was someone who was at Netroots Nation where at the podium, at the main stage, there would be a union speaker and there would be this and there would be that. And there were all these candidate representatives there for both Senate and House races in the Democratic Party at this meeting. And this friend of ours told us that union would stand up and they'd clap politely, and so-and-so would stand up and they'd clap politely, and then Move On got up there, and these clipboards and notepads came out, and people started taking notes.
Uh-huh.
And our friend said, money.
Yep.
The reason they took notes when Move On got up there to speak was money.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't get more pure than that. I mean, we can't be... I don't know how to put this, but we got to understand that it's money. And the big news that came out yesterday, the way it was framed on the Lawrence O'Donnell show was, after Barack Obama's interview came out, Barack Obama raised $1 million in an hour and a half.
Yep. Yep.
Money.
Money. Money. And money matters. Well, money, yeah. Money and votes matter. Money and focused attention,
votes,
focused
yeah.
votes.
Yeah.
And I will, if you will indulge me, I will read 20 seconds from this article I fished out of the memory hole from DLC. This was because I wrote this post about this a couple days ago, but this was about the DLC, the Democratic Leadership Conference or Council, is Bill Clinton's organization. It's the centrist, third way Democratic approach that you and I both rather despise. And this was from 2007, and the article says, not a single of the eight presidential candidates plans to attend the Democratic Leadership Council summer meeting, a snub that says less about the centrist DLC than it does about a nomination process that rewards candidates who pander to their party's hardened cores while ignoring everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
They have tunnel vision, DLC founder Al Fromm said of his fellow Democrats. Fromm said he has nothing against Clinton's wife, Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton of New York, or the other seven political candidates. He even understands why they won't attend, but that doesn't make him worry any less about the future of the party. Presidents are elected in the middle, and they're elected by being bigger than their party. Neither party's activists alone can elect someone president, Fromm said. Democrats have a long history of nominating people, including people who have lost badly. The challenge for Democrats is to nominate somebody who can win the election. What a fucking asshole.
Yep.
Seriously. And that, there was, all I'm trying to say is this. There was a moment when the partisan water, when the centrist waters were parted and Marcos Melitzas, people like that, got on to meet the press to make their case. And then the centrist waters closed back over them, and that never happened again. But there was a moment there at the end of the Bush administration where Howard Dean and the 50 state strategy, yep, and talking about your passions and talking about honesty and talking about integrity in politics and at least talking a good game about all those things made people so interested in politics and so excited about the prospect of putting this zombie dead ass Republican monster and its centrist enabler into the ground forever, once and for all, that it got them enough focus and power to get them onto major talk shows where they could make their case. And then it went away. That's the bad news. But it was possible to blast through that, if only for a moment. And I take a little heart in that. Because It's not that they're impenetrable. They can be motivated to force they can be forced to allow other people's opinion on the air, as long as it becomes unbearably painful for them not to do so.
Right, right. And we have to be the media and make that happen. Absolutely.
And we're not now. I mean, of the moment, we're just a bunch of, you know, we're back to being a bunch of fringe yelpers at the edge of politics complaining about shit that in 5 years everyone will agree was certainly the right thing to do. And aren't we glad we went this way? And we'll be on to something else. But that's the fate of being a liberal, I suppose.
I'm proud of what we do, though, Driftglass.
Oh, me too. Me too. It's a little exhausting at times. Back when I went to school, getting shit right on the test counted more than getting shit wrong.
Yeah, that's not the case anymore.
Fat lot I learned when I was in school. I learned all the wrong lessons, let me tell you.
Well, on a lighter note, I just want to mention that Michelle Bachmann now has dual citizenship with Switzerland.
Yeah. Isn't that nice?
And I said on our Facebook page yesterday that Bachmann loves America so much she gave half her citizenship to a foreign country where she can watch Mitt Romney's money for him. So, well, and I don't know how that's even legal that she can hold office.
Joe Lieberman does.
What? I'm sorry?
I was going to say Joe Lieberman does.
Yeah.
In all but name, Joe Lieberman is a...
Yeah, that's true.
They look
citizen
good
of Israel.
Member.
Oh, it's unbelievable when he's standing there next to Bibi. I wonder how the hell he has the right to represent anyone, let alone his own constituents.
Maybe Dick, you know, the now that Lieberman is dropping out, the Lieberman party is looking for a candidate. Maybe Dick Lugar can step into that.
The Likudiman party. Yeah. Yes. Okay. But this brings up another issue about the Constitution, and we have a child in our house who's 13, and he has been studying the U.S. Constitution this spring for the Illinois Constitution test, which 7th graders have to know the Constitution, which is really awesome, and it's been very cool to study the Constitution with my son. And one of the things that we found out in studying the Constitution is that states are not allowed to form treaties with foreign countries. It's Article 2, Section 2, Clause 2 of the United States Constitution. And I want to read it. Here's the full text. The president shall have power by and with advice and consent of the Senate to make treaties, provided two-thirds of the senators present concur. And then it talks about how the states cannot make treaties.
Mm-hmm.
But for good or ill, states have been making treaties in the past 2 weeks, or negating treaties, attempting to negate treaties, and it just amazes me. Mm-hmm. In Kansas and Arizona, there is now and one Arizona Democrat said, look, the conspiracy theorists have just taken over our state. Mm-hmm. I give up. There is something called the United Nations Agenda 21, which is a sustainability agreement that Bill Clinton signed as an executive order. He ratified. It was never ratified by the Senate because the Senate is broken, in case we haven't said that before.
Yes. Yes, it is.
But Agenda 21 talks about the funny-looking light bulbs and sustainable building practices and those kind of things. It's about sustainable development and responsible environmental stewardship. That's what – oh, and also safe disposition of nuclear waste is in there too, okay?
Yes.
Just so we're clear – nuclear bombs and nuclear energy waste are supposed to be disposed of in a environmentally sound manner.
Yeah, very controversial stuff.
All the UN people said, yeah, that's a good idea. But
use more efficient light bulbs and watch where you throw your nuclear waste. Yeah, a lot of controversy there.
But
Blue Gal, freedom.
As Mother Jones put it, Kansas takes critical step to protect Kansas from the world.
Yeah.
And Kansas and Arizona... who knew, are both taking the lead in de-ratifying.
Nullifying.
And nullifying this agreement in their state, which is really having some pretty serious consequences. Arizona, actually, the bill stalled in the legislature, and let me say... the bill stalled in the legislature because I think people realized that they were wasting a lot of money on something that was going to be just cast down as unconstitutional immediately. And they're kind of feeling like they're in trouble in Arizona. People are even the pig people are starting to notice just how bad things are. You know, and our Swiss senator, our Swiss Miss Senator Michelle Bachmann,
I prefer my acronym, frankly.
Go ahead and tell everyone what your acronym is.
The Swiss Smarmy Wife. So
yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I'm here all week.
The Swiss Smarmy Wife, Michelle Bachmann. She said that Agenda 21 would effectively ban the manufacture of light bulbs, and would consign Americans. Other activists said it would consign Americans to live in hobbit houses. So here is this non-binding UN agreement that hasn't been. That hasn't been ratified by the Senate. Excuse me. But it's an unauthorized power grab by radical environmentalists bent on ending private property rights in favor of communism. That's what the two GOP representatives in Topeka said.
And just so you know, that's the actual title of the bill.
Yes.
It's
the radical environmentalist bent on communism bill. Yes.
Yep, it is. But, in the UN. You'd think they would have named it something more innocuous, but no, they went right out and said it was a radical power grab by lunatic commies bill.
Yeah. And it's another Sharia law thing. It really is. It's just, let's find something to be terribly, terribly afraid of.
Yes.
And make sure that we're on it. But it's unconstitutional. Now, on the pro side of this, I think it's equally... unconstitutional, frankly, and I'm in favor of this kind of thing, but on a political side, but I think it's really unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. California and Quebec are near reaching an agreement between the two states for cap and trade on carbon. Now, Quebec and California are making an agreement.
Yes, they are.
On cap and trade. And, I mean, first of all, this just tells you how broken the Senate is and how broken the Congress is, period. Thank you. Thank you for your transparency again, that you're just so broken that states are now deciding that they need to do something about the environment because you never will.
From Kansas to Arizona to North Carolina, what they're saying is we want the hell out of this union.
Yeah.
We don't want to be part of this country. We hate this country. We hate where it's going. We've hated this country ever since the Union Army came down here and told us we couldn't keep slaves. Yeah. We've hated every fucking minute of it. And we really, really, really still haven't gotten over it. And we want the hell out.
Mm-hmm.
And we will take every opportunity to stamp our feet and throw ourselves in the middle of, you know, as I say, lob cinder blocks into traffic to stop this country from being the thing that everybody else wants it to be. We're just not going to put up with it. Now, the Canada, the Quebec and California thing, I don't know. Let me put you a counter case. There are corporations operating, multinational, transnational corporations that are vastly more powerful than individual countries.
Mm-hmm.
Exxon has way more money than most countries do, way more power. They have a longer time horizon than most governments do, and so forth. But U.S. states sign individual agreements with individual transnational companies that are based in other countries all the time. Yeah. To bring car companies here, they compete with each other to lower taxes and slash.
Well, and California has taken the lead on so many environmental things that you will buy products in every state where the label on it will say this complies with California's statute on recyclability or whatever it is. And it says California, everyone talks about the People's Republic of California, but it really has that kind of economic and buying power that they've been able to set the standard for a lot of things. I also want to remind everyone in a sense, with a great sense of tragedy, that Quebec's Minister for Sustainable Development, here's that word again, sustainable, predicted that these kind of programs would grow. The cap-and-trade system is acknowledged as one of the most efficient and least costly economic tools available to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. I want to remind everyone that cap-and-trade was a Republican idea.
Yes, like 12 years ago.
Like,
not
John McCain loved it because it was an alternative. It was the compromise between strict environmental regulation that was going to tell people how much carbon they could release into the air, period. Uh-huh. And an agreement that, you would be able to have some sort of aegis in your own development of improving this. Yeah.
You cap the aggregate amount of carbon that you allow to release and turn it into a market.
Yeah.
And let people
You get to offset it. Yeah.
And buy and sell the right to emit carbon or not. Now, I think that's an interesting idea. I don't think we've ever seen it play out. Markets, there are too many ways to subvert markets, and it's too profitable. But the entire predicate of cap and trade is the idea that
free
everybody
market.
Buys into the fact that carbon release of carbon in massive amounts is a primary cause of global warming, man-made global climate change. And since that is beget by a common acceptance that there is a problem, Republicans now have to take a giant step back and simply attack the science, pretend it isn't a problem. And that makes, that makes solutions irrelevant because there is no problem, because Jesus will come and make everything better and dry every eye. And next time he said it'd be fire anyway. So I don't have a problem with sovereign states acting in a regional way that is binding only on them. The Great Lakes has a manufacturing consortium and an environmental consortium. I know that acts in concert with their opposite numbers in Canada because they all share, fresh water sources and they all share air and natural resources. It'd be great if it could be, federal government to federal government, national government to national government. But if there's agreements can be reached by municipal governments all the time. It is when you bind someone into a treaty that says that you're acting sort of in opposition to your national government by forming a side treaty that says essentially, no, we're going to let you not abide by your other obligations in our special back door here. That's when you get into trouble. This is, the Romans knew this. I believe I have it right that Romans, their conquered lands could keep their gods, could keep their government pretty much.
Yep.
The two things they couldn't do was mint their own coins and conduct foreign policy. Yep. And that was pretty much it.
And challenge the power of the emperor. Yeah.
And that's how they maintain peace. And it seems to work pretty well. If you want to have an empire, that seems a pretty good way to do it. So I don't have a particular problem with that. I agree with you. It's a good thing. But I think there's a very big difference between two sovereign governments coming to some sort of mutually beneficial agreement that affects nobody but themselves and a punk-ass state like Kansas deciding it's going to nullify non-existent treaty.
Well, first of all, a non-binding treaty that and it actually has, as I said, it has serious consequences for Arizona in terms of contracts they've signed to build buildings and standards that are, you're not up able to build a sustainable building anymore? Really? Mm-hmm. What kind of business is that? What kind of business are you inviting into your state if you say that? You're just not.
Well,
Blue Gap. It's a
conspiracy. The UN is where the wild things are.
Yeah. Oh, there you go. Full circle. That's very nice. And on that note, we want to thank our listeners. You guys are wonderful, and thank you so much for your contributions to our podcast. We appreciate your support. Many people have taken advantage and have asked for the button on our podcast website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can automatically give $5, $10, or $15 a month to support us as a subscriber. And we appreciate that support so much. It makes such a difference to us. Thank you. We had a letter this week from one of our listeners, Sharon, and she said, just want to say thank you for taking the time to do this podcast. You're welcome, Sharon. I don't watch or listen to the news, including NPR, because it all makes me crazy. I'm not sure how you two keep from going crazy yourselves, but thank you for taking the hit for the rest of us. You two make me feel sane, even though you were talking about crazy people and their wacky ideas. Yes, we certainly were today. I must say, this is a wacky show. Mm-hmm. I have a small bit of hope for this country because I know you're out there. Wow. Thank you, Sharon.
Thanks, Sharon.
I made a donation through PayPal to help keep you going. Thanks a million. And again, you are welcome, and we thank you, Sharon, for your contribution. Again, there's a PayPal button. You can give a one-time gift or subscribe to our podcast at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com. We also have a P.O. Box where you can mail a letter or contribution. That is P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791. We have an email address. It is proleftpodcast@gmail.com, and we love hearing from you. Feel free to write us anytime. You can listen to our podcast for free with no download and no registration at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, at our Facebook page, which is on fire. Everyone is over there having a great time, and we appreciate you guys so much. Did I tell you last week we had our 666th like on
yes.
Facebook? That was awesome. We're up
yes.
in the 680s now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Frances Langum on Facebook, L-A-N-G-U-M. If you want to friend me, I'll friend you back. We're on iTunes and through our fabulous app available at the iTunes Store, the Professional Left app. We're on the amazing Stitcher Radio, and we are on Netroots Radio from 6 to 7 Pacific and 9 to 10 Eastern Time Saturday nights at netrootsradio.blogspot.com. At our Facebook page and website, we post every week a picture of an internet kitty sent in by you. If you want your internet kitty to appear on the website, just send us a picture of your internet kitty and put internet kitty on the subject line of your email. This week's internet kitty is Max. He or she is a snowshoe Siamese. And I have been told has been relegated to be a barn kitty because of his bladder behavior, not to get into too many details, but he is now a barn cat. And so he's also our internet kitty this week, and we're very glad to have him on our website and Facebook page.
Barn cats are important.
They are. They perform an important service.
Mm-hmm.
And we have some news about our internet kitties as well.
Yeah. Yeah. One of our two internet kitties, good old Jake, passed away this weekend. Jake was a good old cat.
Yeah.
And
even the vet liked her.
Even the vet thought, and yes, Jake was a girl, and deal
yeah.
with it. Jake, I found Jake when I was working in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And my older cat had passed away a little while before. And this little tiny cat came to live outside the building where I worked. And for a couple, 3 days in a row, several hundred people would come flooding into the building around the same time. And a couple, 3 days in a row, Jake threaded her way through the crowd and came up to me and bumped me on the shin with her little tiny head. And after 2 or 3 days, I got through my thick skull that this was supposed to be my cat. So the guys at the dock had been feeding her for a few days. So I put her in my coat and took her to the vet, and Jake became my cat. And a little while later, she begat some kittens, which was a surprise to me. A surprise to the vet who didn't tell me about it.
Yeah.
And I dreamed up all kinds of reasons since I knew she couldn't be pregnant.
Why she was gaining so much weight. Yeah, yeah.
So symmetrically and so forth. And I was a moron because I had already locked it into my head why the obvious answer could not be the right answer. But Jake was a real good cat for a real long time. Jake loved everybody, bonded with everybody. And when I moved to Springfield, Jake walked right in the door, and the kids, this is their first large mammal pet.
Yeah.
I think
it'd
be fair to say. Mm-hmm. Was very good for them, and they were very good for her.
Yeah.
And immediately she took to a schedule. Every night she'd run upstairs and make sure they were in their beds.
Yes,
and
she check did. On them. She really did and mother them. Yeah.
She did.
Yeah.
She totally did. And walked around and whipped her tail around. And right up until the very end, when she was having real trouble eating,
yep,
there was a lot of maintenance and stuff. She still was the good old cat that we had loved for so long. So
she slept in the girls' rooms even when she was sick. Mm-hmm. She slept in there a lot and spent the night up in the girls' room and looked over them. So, yeah, we're very grateful that she was a part of our lives. Yeah.
This is not a dirge show. This
and we're happy. And I do think even after her death, she taught the children a lot and taught them a valuable lesson about passing and missing someone and all of those lessons that we all have to learn in life. I think she gave a lot to the kids. So
she did.
Very,
she
very
did.
Glad so, she was a part of our lives. And her daughter is still a part of our lives being crazy. And we are not a cat-free home and never will be. But
no. ain't going to happen.
We miss Jake, and we're glad that she was a part of our lives. So, Driftglass, how are the Internet Kitties doing this week?
Well, Blue Gal, the Internet Kitties were just kidding about Dick Luger's new lobbying job at Lockheed Martin.
Let's think about living. Let's think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the popping and the loving, lovey-doving. Let's forget about the whining and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with the switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
This podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license, copyright 2012, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast. And I have no idea whether Dick Luger has a new lobbying job at Lockheed Martin or not, but I bet he will.
I heard a rumor about it on this really good podcast where they obsessed over some dead kitten.
I'll bet he's going to be lobbying within. They have to go a year now because the law says they have to wait a year.
Yeah, he'll be president of a college for a year.
Yeah.
And he'll work at the Defense Policy Institute, and he'll get a job at the John F. Kennedy School of Government,
he'll
go on tour at the Hoover, and he'll be feted, and he'll be carpeted, and he'll be, you know, handed from think tank to think tank, and he will lend his expertise. Although I told you that if
Mitt Romney had any balls,
if Mitt Romney wanted a three-corner bank shot, he'd announce Dick Lugar was his vice presidential candidate tomorrow.
Yep.
He would not have the Benson problem.
Nope.
Lloyd Benson problem. He is old enough. Mitt Romney's old enough in his own right not to look like a child sitting next to him. He has no foreign policy experience. Romney does, other than sending your jobs overseas. So it would shore
Luger
up that.
Has a lot of foreign policy experience. So there you go.
It would tell.
It's his sister soldier moment. Is Dick Luger?
Exactly. Yeah. He would. He could tell the Tea Partiers to fuck off.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know. And Luger is a real conservative. It's not like he's some sort of sweet, you know, middle of the aisle moderate.
Well, except that he voted for Sonia Sotomayor, which to the Tea Party means he's a commie.
No, he's a commie. He's a dirty, stinking commie.
So
and he's old.
Just, yeah.
And that would be a really
smart thing
creative,
to do.
And it would get
if he'd take the job, which
there is that. And it would also give Mitt Romney something to talk about to moderates other than you know, same bullshit he's been told.
Well, and he wouldn't fuck up like a lot of other people who would, you know, come out and say stuff that they don't really mean. I mean, he's seasoned, so.
His only problem really is he talks like a senator.
Yeah.
After, you know, after what, he's been in the Senate now for 700 years?
Yeah, I think so.
At some point, you just can't talk like a human after a while. And it becomes a real problem. Mm-hmm. And you and I have seen that. And he is well beyond his freshness date. He should have retired a couple of terms ago. But it would be a bold move without being a catastrophically stupid Sarah Palin move, which means that the ever cautious Mitt Romney will probably never do
that. Never do that.